This is The Literary Life. I'm Mitchell Kaplan. I've owned Books and Books and been a bookseller for over 35 years. What you're about to hear are conversations about all things literary, with writers, readers, publishers, old friends, new friends, and anyone who might wander into our store with an interesting story to tell about their connection to books, reading, or writing. These will be informal, over the backyard fence kind of conversations, the kind I and booksellers everywhere have each and every day. Alex Segura is the author of the Pete Fernandez mystery series set in Miami. He's written short stories that appeared in numerous anthologies and a number of best-selling and critically acclaimed comic books. He also co-writes the Lethal Lit podcast. This is the short version of his biography. I couldn't give you the long version without exhausting myself. So what we're going to do is talk to Alex, who's my guest today on The Literary Life, to go over all the myriad things that this kid from Miami does. We're proud to call him one of our own. We're celebrating the publication of the final Pete Fernandez mysteries called Miami Midnight, of which no one less than Robert Cray says, expertly weaving the past and present, Alex Segura masterfully cranks the tension while revealing the demons that both haunt P.I. Pete Fernandez and drive him forward. Blackout will hook you on Fernandez and Alex Segura. Let's have more, and soon. And we do have more. We have Miami Midnight. Alex, welcome to The Literary Life.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's always a treat to be at Books and Books. It's like, I know a book has come out and we're celebrating it in a meaningful way when I'm here. So,
well, and that's because of your background. I mean, you grew up here in Miami, didn't you?
Yeah, born and raised. So events here are a little different because it's like, Alex, this is your life. You know, I'll see a teacher from middle school. I'll see my parents. I'll see friends from different eras. It's almost like a nice culmination of all the work.
Talk a little bit about what it was like growing up in Miami as a kid who loved to read and who loved to write.
Yeah, I was born, you know, I was raised in Kendall and Westchester, so I was a suburbs kid. My parents are Cuban, and they came over as the Castro Revolution hit, like so many people.
So they came over in the early 60s.
Yeah, and they were very young, and I spent a lot of time with my abuelos, my grandparents, and I got into comics and crime fiction at a pretty early age, probably maybe younger than I should have. I remember pulling off a copy of The Godfather from my grandfather's shelf when I was like 8 or 9. And then he saw me reading it and he was like, what are you doing? By then, Sonny had died and a lot of stuff had happened. And I just kind of got this taste for really dark fiction. And comics, I have really vivid memories of walking to the comic shop down the street and just making that my world. I was a pretty bookish, introverted kid. But
Well, and you also grew up at a time when there was a lot of dark fiction being written here. I mean, the work of Charlie Williford.
Yeah.
Talk about some of the other writers that influenced you.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Williford's books is that they present Miami as it is. I feel like it's quirky, it's weird, it's not just this tropical paradise. There's a lot of simmering danger under there. And he, you don't read a Williford book for plot. You read it for vibe and energy and tone. And he's got this great flavor. Those Hoke Mosley books are things that I just read for comfort. I'll go back like Hoke Mosley and anything by Elmore Leonard of the Florida stuff, I'll read just as kind of comfort food.
Is it a Miami and South Florida that you recognize, or were you too young to have really experienced it that way?
I was a little young. I mean, I have some memories of like, you know, the crime and things like that, but it's almost like an archaeological experiment to go back and see what it was like, because the Miami in the Pete books is the Miami I remember. And it's, you know, we'll probably talk about this a little too, but, you know, as I spend more time away from Miami, every book becomes more almost research intensive. So trips like this, when I'm in town, become almost like research trips. And, you know, I'll be taking a walk in the park with my wife and I'll mention, you know, this is a great spot for a murder. And she's like, you know, we're on vacation. You really shouldn't be thinking, well, where's your head at? But that's kind of, I'm not good at vacationing. I'm not good at relaxing. And so even stuff like this is studying. Oh, thank you.
Yes, we're here at the cafe at Books and Books, and Alex is drinking a cappuccino, and I'm having a cortadito.
Nice.
How's the coffee up in New York compared to Miami?
I mean, you can't top a Cuban coffee. So, I mean, we were joking about this, but when I told my wife that they'd give me coffee as a young kid, her eyes just kind of bulged open. Like, what kind of a life did you lead? But, you know, you can't top Cuban coffee. So coffee in New York is fine.
Do you remember Enrique Fernandez at all? Was he at the Herald when you were there?
I don't think I was there at the same time.
Enrique Fernandez has written, he's no longer with us, but he has this great line about Cuban food in the United States. And he said, he talks about Cuban food in New York City. And he says, the only thing Cuban about the most restaurants in New York City is Gloria Estefan coming out of the speaker system. Right.
Yeah, I mean, Cuban food in New York is fine, but it's not Miami Cuban food. You know, no, it's got this gourmet vibe that if you eat Cuban food in Miami, you know, it's not about gourmet. It's about family style. You know, you're just getting a lot of good food and flavor. It's not about how that's presented.
So you were a reader. You read all this stuff. You read Miami. You read Miami mysteries and other mysteries as well. And then you discovered comics.
Yeah, comics were really eye-opening for me. I mean, my dad was a fan. And I grew, my first comic book experience was at Archie, ironically, which is where it's my day job at Archie. And so I think my mom just got that my first book for me to kind of quiet me down in line at Publix as a little kid. And then it became this lifelong thing, which, you know, now I can kind of hold that over them and say, you know, you shouldn't have put them in the basement when I behaved badly or the garage, because that's the one thing they would take away if I did something wrong. It's like, well, your comics are going to go away. So
why is it that so many mystery writers, do you think, started off reading comics as well? I think of Brad Meltzer, and I think of some others
too. Yeah, Brad's a great example. I mean, I think it's just the weaving of the stories, and it's this kind of propulsive narrative, like every issue leads into the next one, and you have this tapestry of story. And if you read enough comics, you basically have a novel. You know, people write these books for years and years and years, and it's almost these epic sagas that it kind of tunes you into writing a novel, which is very much like 2 or 3 years worth of comics. And these are very, you know, different and varied characters and colorful personalities. And that really fit in to me with Miami and just the vibe here.
Well, so let's talk about that long version of your bio. So I know we've hinted at some of it. So your day job is with Archie Comics.
Right.
You also have a podcast.
Right.
Talk about that a little bit.
So Lethal Lit was a podcast I co-wrote with Monica Gallagher. And it's a fiction podcast, so it's recorded like a audio drama, different actors voice different characters, but the twist is that it's recorded to sound like a true crime podcast. So you listen to it and it sounds like Serial, or it sounds like Accused, or one of these reported podcasts, and a lot of found noise. And the story follows this young girl, Tig Torres, who comes from New York City to her small hometown of Hollow Falls, which is a fictional city like Twin Peaks. Basically to reinvestigate these serial murders that happened in Hollow Falls that people have pinned on her aunt who died, who was, you know, people believe she committed these crimes and then killed herself. But Tig believes very strongly that her aunt was innocent and that it was somebody else. And so it tells the story of her as this kind of high school, like Nancy Drew, reinvestigating the crime and kind of dealing with the weight of the history this had, you know, the effect that these crimes had on the town and the pushback that the town has on it actually being solved.
And where can people find Lethal Lit?
You can find it on whatever podcast app. Apple.
Called Lethal Lit.
Lethal Lit, yeah. So very, there's one season cool. out now.
And you know, it's named one of the best five podcasts by the New York Times in 2018.
Yeah, that was amazing.
That's
that was,
pretty remarkable, yeah, yeah. isn't it?
It was just a great validation of all the work. You know, the Einhorn's Epic Productions produced it, and they were really passionate about getting it to sound
right. So you write the stories for it.
We wrote the scripts, and we were involved in some level of the recording, and we created the characters. So,
which brings me to the fact that you've also written a number of comic books as well, right? So you wrote the Black Ghost noir superhero tale, and then you've written some of the Archie stuff too.
Yeah, which is kind of a dream. I mean, Archie was my introduction to the medium, and so... when I got my job there doing publicity years ago, now I'm co-president, so I have more oversight over different things. It's like,
tell me what that means. So, when you say you're overseeing the Archie, you're co-president of the Archie Comics. Mm-hmm. Are they a standalone group?
Yeah, standalone company. Yeah,
it's a company just called Archie Comics.
Family owned. Yeah, it's still owned by the same structure. And
are they in Riverdale?
Close enough. Yeah, no, we're up in Pelham. in Westchester. Oh, is that right? Yeah. So, though it's never been confirmed that the Riverdale in the Archie comics is the Riverdale in New York. Oh, is that true? Yeah. It's like this vague, like metropolis type area. Like it's, you know, it's in the Northeast because they have seasons, but
that's. I think what's so cool is that generations, like my generation and your generation, we can both share a knowledge of Archie comics. Mm-hmm. You know, because that was something that I read when I was a kid.
Yeah, and it's really in the limelight now with Riverdale, the show, and Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, and now Katie Keene. So it's a whole new fandom has been brought in, which is amazing. So coming into that job, when I first did, I was doing marketing and publicity, and I kind of sheepishly asked, like, can I write one of these comics? And that got the ball rolling. And,
which was your first one?
My first one was a story where Archie and his friends go to a Riverdale comic convention. And so it's called the Great Riverdale Comic Con. And it's about solving this mystery and figuring out, even then there was a mystery component, even in an Archie story, just figuring out who was dressed as this character and committing these kind of dastardly deeds at the comic convention. So it was funny. You have Jughead dressed as Spock and you have Archie dressed as like Pureheart the Powerful. So it was fun. And it was, you know, I don't go back and read that because you always cringe at your older stuff, but I'm glad it exists.
I also love what's coming up. You have talk about that. Archie meets the B-52s.
Yeah, soon. I think, next week, Archie meets the B-52s comes out, and it's a one-shot. And for stuff like these, we actually have to get the buy-in of the band. We reached out to the B-52s. The artist, Dan Parent, reached out to Fred Schneider and said, hey, you know, we've done Ramones, we've done Kiss, we've done Blondie. Like, would you guys want to do it? And he said, we are totally in. Let's do it.
Did Fred want to look at the look of it? Because I know he does his own.
Yeah.
He does his own illustration.
Yeah. No, we sent everything to the management and they passed it to the band. And, you know, we've done so many of these collaborations and each one is unique. Like, you're kind of dealing with the personalities of the musicians. But the B-52s have been top to bottom, easy to deal with.
And then the Ramones you have coming up.
Yeah.
Kiss.
Yeah, Ramones and Kiss happened. And those were, you know, just, I was a big Ramones fan as a kid and I love the B-52s and Kiss, they're comic book characters themselves. So it was easy to just have them be themselves in Riverdale. So I think the challenge is like, what's your conceit? Like, how do you make each one different? It can't just be like the Archies are having a gig and then they open for this band. Like, so for the Ramones, they actually travel back in time to the CBGB's era. And Kiss, like,
oh wow,
Kiss is like summoned from a different dimension and they show up in Riverdale. And I think the B-52s, I just said, let's just set it in the 80s. Like, Archie was around in the 80s, the B-52s were around in the 80s. And that way you get the original lineup of the B-52s with Ricky Wilson too. So
you could go all the way back to the 60s.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Archie can meet a lot of bands.
We did the Monkees as well.
Yeah. Oh, did you? Yeah,
that was neat. So we drew it started drawn in like the current modern style, and then Archie gets bonked on the head and they're suddenly in the retro style and the Monkees are there. So
now, is there digital versions of these comics as well? So people can experience them digitally.
Yeah. You can get them on the Archie app, or Comixology is like the main vendor for digital comics. Yeah.
Wow.
It's all over.
The world has shifted, hasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. No, you know, the Black Ghost, which is the kind of the vigilante crime comic I created, is only digital. So you can only get it on Comixology.
You know, I notice when Brad comes and does an event at the bookstore, and I'm sure it happens all across the country, there is a good amount of people in the audience who come because they know him from his comics work. Does that happen with you too when you make appearances?
Yeah, you know, I'll always, even if it's just a Pete Fernandez event or something, I can always bank on one or two Archie comics. Like, what did you guys do? Because I think fans know he has some executive say in the company. So they have like very focused questions, which is neat. I like being multi-platform is the best way to describe it. Like doing comics, doing podcasts, doing novels. And Brad's an old friend. Like, I've known Brad since I think I first got in the industry. He's such a kind, helpful guy. Like, really
one of the most generous people around, I think.
I think before I'd even started writing the first novel, Silent City, we were talking and he was like, what are you up to? And I said, well, I'm writing this book on the side. He said, when you're done, I will blurb it. Just tell me and I'll do it. I mean, he read it, but that was really validating and huge. And he didn't have to do that.
Well, you know, Miami is one of those kinds of places where the writing community here is very, very, the writing community is extremely generous, I think.
Yeah.
Now, you went to FIU for a little while, right? In the writing program?
No, I was an English lit major.
Oh, you were I thought you were getting an MFA.
No, I did. I joke about this with Lynn Barrett, who's a friend, who now we've become friends over the years, is that I was probably like her worst creative writing student. And I think she was frustrated because I think she was like, you're good. You know, maybe you could come to class. But she's great. And that whole program is so impressive. And I've chatted with her. I've become friends with other graduates of the program over time. So
Tell me, you know, again, I told you I was going to get exhausted talking to you this other stuff as well. So tell me about your Star Wars stuff too.
So, I mean, Star Wars, I'll be doing a Star Wars Poe Dameron book, which is coming out in August. And basically the idea is that it'll explore his time before you meet him in the new movies. So kind of what leads him into those movies. So that's a huge honor, and I'm excited to do it. I know they're going to ramp up their like PR machine for...
Is that coming out with pocketbooks or...?
It's coming out with Disney. Yeah.
Oh, Disney's
out. So it's coming out in August. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Well, congratulations.
Yeah, it's cool.
I know that you're not allowed to talk too much about it.
Yeah, but it's still early, but I'm excited. I think I can't believe it's happening.
So you also, beyond all of this, mm-hmm. We're all going to hate you, but you also play music, right?
You know this, like once you start having kids, it's... Some hobbies have to fall by the wayside. But when I first moved to New York, I was in a band and we played gigs in Brooklyn.
Oh, you were in bands in
Miami. Yeah, it was bands down here too. A lot of them were not successful, but some were. You know, we put out an EP when I was in Brooklyn, in New York. And music's always been a big part of just my life and kind of DNA, you know. So even now, I guess now not playing much, it'll still get into the comics and like using that language. Like, and I'll sometimes people reach out with suggestions or pitches and they know, you know, music is part of, and the Pete books are really seeped in music. You know, I wanted to make that a big part of his personality in the same way that, you know, Harry Bosch listens to jazz.
Right.
Pete loves indie rock and Talking Heads, the Pixies and stuff like that, or Nico Case. And I'm just like, I really think about like found music when I'm writing, like what would he be putting on his car stereo or what's playing in his record player at his apartment? You can't really have much music while he's getting shot at, but you know, there are these like little lulls in the story.
So let's talk about Pete.
Okay.
But let's first talk a little bit about, you know, you mentioned some of your influences. Talk about some others that are outside of people, writers who are associated with Miami. People like George Pelicanos, I know, had quite an influence.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. When I first got my first gig in comics, I had to move up to New York, and they always say, you know, when your hobbies become your job, they're not as much fun. And that's partially true. I still love comics, but I started reading a lot of mystery novels for fun. And I'd read some already, but I read a lot of current, you know, PI novels like George Pelicanos and Laura Lippman and Dennis Lehane. And what really struck me about those authors is that not only were the characters really flawed, you know, they either was addiction or just personality or just their own issues, the stories really spoke to you in terms of setting. So you read a Pelicanos book, you're in DC. You see DC through his eyes. The same with Boston and Dorchester with the Dennis Lehane books. And I, you know, in the hubris of that time, I was like, well, I should try that for Miami. You know, and I was also really homesick. I had just moved up to New York, and New York is a very, right. I don't want to say brutal, though brutal is probably the best word. It's you know, that first year is brutal.
Did you move there alone?
Yeah. Yeah. I just got an apartment. I had some family there. Like my aunt lives there. But I didn't really know that many people. I got this tiny apartment in Queens, you know, with roommates. But
with all the people surrounding you, I guess New York could be a very lonely place
right. When
you're first there.
Yeah, because you are surrounded with people, but it's not people you can really communicate with. So I was still homesick about Miami, and I was reading these books, and my first thought was, well, let me just try it. And that eventually became Silent City.
Well, clearly you also remembered and were influenced by some of these Miami folks that were more contemporary, like James W. Hall. Mm-hmm. And I was very interested to know and to read that you were influenced as well by Vicki Hendrick.
Oh, yeah. She's fantastic.
That is, her stuff is amazing and not read very much.
I feel like whenever anyone asks,
she's not even in Miami anymore, I don't think, right now.
We did a Miami Noir at the Bar at Miami Book Fair a few years back, and it was really an honor to have her read. And she read something from one of her new books, and I just had to take her aside and say, thank you so much. Like, I don't think this would happen. I don't think I would have become this writer if I hadn't read Miami Purity when I did, because it was such a game-changing book for me. Because it wasn't just that it tonally matched those other books I was reading. It talked about Miami in a way that I could recognize, like the humidity, the characters, the kind of double-crossing, and also the kind of the suburban malaise that sometimes can set in. You know, Miami's big. People forget that. People think, oh, Miami's just this, like, beach town. It's big. It's sprawling. It's diverse. It's complicated. you know.
I remember when Vicky wrote, you know, that was her first, her first novel, and it was published by the great Sonny Mehta, who just passed recently away, passed away, you know, sadly. And Vicky, I think Sonny was so taken with just the things that you talked about, was taken with, you know, how it described a Miami that was the underbelly of Miami in a lot of ways, with a really kind of perverse sense of humor as well, and an openness. I mean, it was as graphic
and it was sexy,
as anything you would ever want to imagine.
But it never felt salacious. It always felt like she was doing it with a brush. You know, she was very thoughtfully crafting these scenes, and it felt, it was, you know, it's like the Postman Always Rings Twice, but from a Miami perspective.
Right,
and
that was really, I think, the idea.
Yeah,
in her mind,
and it was just so perfectly. And I've read all of it. I've read all her other stuff, but you know that that book has holds a special place for me. It's just the kind of thing that, you know, I don't know if I would be writing if it, she hadn't written that, which, you know,
that's quite a great thing.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about Pete then. How did Pete come to be?
So I think right around that same time when I thought, you know, I'm going to try this, I think this is the comic book influences that, that plays a part is I didn't read a lot of PI series where you saw the origin story or how these characters came to be, you know, like Raymond Chandler, Marlowe is there, you know, he's this kind of tainted knight and he exists that way, but you never find out what made Marlowe Marlowe or what made, you know, the Ross McDonald books, what made that character come to be. And I was really interested in showing the mistakes that a PI would make on the way and making those mistakes in Miami. And I really wanted him to be Cuban and I really wanted him to have a realistic relationship with addiction. I didn't want it to be something where he just sidles up to the bar and knocks back a few martinis and suddenly he can drive off and save the day. And I didn't want him to save the day all the time. I wanted him to get beat up and like learn, eventually get better. So the whole arc, these five novels are really his story of not just becoming a PI, but becoming a person. You know, by the end, I don't want to spoil anything, but by the last book, you kind of say, okay, this is where he's going to leave off. Whether he's alive or dead, I leave that to the readers. But, you know, it's, I felt like it was a good point to just say.
So in essence, the whole arc of the series is the origin story of Pete.
Yeah, I was less interested in doing the kind of Law and Order episodic stories that, that you see in a lot of PI series and a lot of people do really well, but I was more interested in the character-driven stuff where each book you see him take a leap. You know, from Silent City to Down the Darkest Street, he goes into recovery. And Down the Darkest Street, he kind of relapses. And in the third book, you get this kind of Cuban history element to it. So each book is really whatever I'm obsessing over in that moment. And, you know, you kind of serve yourself as your initial audience, and then hopefully somebody else will be interested in what you're doing.
Well, in the new one, I was very pleased to see that he decided that he wanted to have a bookstore as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I was very pleased about that.
It's a tough business.
It's a very tough business, and you did a really great job.
Oh, good. Thanks, yeah.
So it's very realistic, too.
Yeah, that was, you know, that was a nod to, I mean, you travel for these books and you promote them and you go to different bookstores and you know it's a passion project. You know, it's a love of words and books and authors. And just to have a little sliver of that in this book was kind of a thank you to booksellers everywhere, indie booksellers.
Well, we thank you for that. And also, he's got a really terrific therapist in this one as well.
Yeah, that was part of the journey. And I think for him, you know, he is sober for most of the series, but that comes with its own pratfalls and you don't necessarily fix all your problems. And I just had a realization after three books, I was like, he's been through a lot of stuff and he probably needs some help. And if he's smart enough, he'll get it. And I didn't want his therapist to be the typical kind of foil for plot. I really wanted them to have a meaningful exchange and to kind of plant some seeds. So you have, there's an initial scene where he's chatting with the therapist about, you know, how he's never going to do this again. And she's kind of saying, well, you're working out, you're doing all this stuff. That tells me you are going to do something. And then the book kind of kicks off after that. But I really wanted someone to be a little bit of a gut check for him and kind of call him on his BS.
Yeah, well, it's reminiscent of the Sopranos relationship.
Yeah, exactly.
I think yours is as human, if not more human, in terms of the relationship that they have.
Yeah, and I think anytime you go into therapy, you're looking for somebody to kind of tilt the frame a little bit and maybe give you a different perspective of the things that you're dealing with, like in the weeds. And that's kind of what I wanted that scene to do, to really.
And she also has a great last name. So
yeah, exactly.
You'll have to read the book to find out.
I don't want to spoil it.
Why we're saying that. So Alex, with everything you're doing, What's and you're young, and so what's next?
Oh, thanks. What's next is I'm finishing up the Star Wars novel, which is exciting, and I'm hoping we'll do another volume of The Black Ghost for Comixology. And I'm working on a standalone, my first standalone crime novel, which I'm finishing up, and then once I'm done, I'll shop it around. But the idea is it's going to be a female protagonist. She's from Miami. She'll move up to New York, and she'll have to solve a crime that she wasn't expecting it's to solve. She's not a PI. She's not an investigator. She stumbles into the situation where she has to play the role of amateur sleuth. And it'll be tonally gritty and dark. But there'll be some elements that I want to kind of keep in my back pocket, but soon.
Tell me about how you discovered Polis Books, or they discovered you, and what is that relationship like?
Oh, it's been great. They've been very supportive. And I knew Jason Pinter, who's the founder of Polis. And, you know, once I knew that I published Silent City initially in 2013 with a very small house. And it was the kind of situation where you don't have much distribution. I'm bringing books to bookstores. And it was, you know, they were very supportive, but I really wanted to level up. I already had the second manuscript kind of in the can. And I reached out to Jason and we met and, you know, he seemed really simpatico. He was like, I'm a fan of these books and I will support you. And he's really been, he's provided this kind of great home for these books that will live on, which is really nice to see.
Polis has an amazing list, actually.
Yeah.
I know that today at the bookshop, you'll be with Steph Post, for instance.
Yeah. And Steph is like kind of, we joke, she's like the other side of the coin. Like I do the dark Miami, you know, metropolitan noir, and she does this rural North Florida stuff. And we're both ending our series right around the same time. We'd always joked about doing a story where Pete would meet up with Judah Cannon, but that might have to wait.
We would love for you to read a little bit of the book.
I'd be happy
if that's something you'd like to do.
Okay, the section is called Big Exit. January 1st, 1984. You don't want to go in there, Osvaldito. The deputy's words seemed to float in the air around the entrance to the room like fading smoke. As Detective Osvaldo Valdez approached, the deputy backed away. Osvaldo knew he had little choice in the matter. He had to walk into the dim, dank hotel room that was already being cordoned off by yellow tape. The stuffy hallway, reeking of cheap cologne and sweat, had been cramped with uniforms and a forensics unit. But the room itself was empty, aside from the body splayed out near the far window. The woman, late 30s, skinny, brunette, hair cut short but not boyish, lay on the floor at an odd angle. Her head was twisted up, as if trying to look out the dirty, smudged window, the only source of natural light in the dingy hotel room. Osvaldo did his best to keep his footfalls light. He'd been on the Miami homicide team for a little over 6 months. His partner, Tino Vigil, was catching another body downtown. That left Osvaldo here in Overtown, feeling itchy and hot in the decrepit Hampton House Hotel, checking on a body. The owner had called it in, complaining that the man who'd rented the room had bailed, leaving him $50 short. He'd prattled on about the noise, too, the screaming, more than your usual Overtown kerfuffle, more than your usual New Year's Eve partying, too. Serious wailing, thuds, boom, boom, crash, real loud, then dead quiet, too quiet. Osvaldo motioned over his shoulder for one of the uniformed officers, a kid named Mosher, to come in behind him. Don't touch anything yet, okay? Osvaldo said. I want to get a feel for it first. He stepped further into the room, his arms out a bit, palms open, as if trying to catch something, a sign of what had happened there. Static. Nothing. But then, something, as he stepped closer, and a sliver of the New Year's Day sun fell on the woman's face, bruised and bloodied, illuminating the dark purple marks around her neck, scratches streaking down toward her collarbone. Past the cuts and injuries, Osvaldo recognized something. A flicker of familiarity snapped at him. Fuck, he said, his eyes scanning the woman's face once more. Not just a woman, not just a Jane Doe, not anymore. He wheeled around. He felt himself heat up, a sheen of sweat spread over him, prickling his back, then his face. This can't be right. But he knew it was true. Mosher, who had been shadowing his movements, jerked back, surprised by Osvaldo's quick pivot. The detective looked at the younger man with his trimmed beard and eager eyes. Those will fade soon, Osvaldo thought. You'll become a zombie, just like the rest of us. The ones who survive. Get everyone out of here except essential personnel, Osvaldo said, his tone flat, eyes locked on Mosher, who nodded. And then get Carlos Broccia on the phone, fast.
I dare anyone who's just listened to that not to want to run out and buy Miami Midnight, which is the final of the Pete Fernandez mysteries. And then you'll just have to buy them all.
Yeah.
And I just have no issue, you know, there's been binge watching. This is binge reading.
Exactly.
So just get through them all. Alex Segura, thank you so much for being
here. Oh, thanks so much for having me. This was a treat and an honor.